Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Nzinga Harrison, a well-respected physician and educator. Dr. Harrison is the chief medical officer and co-founder of Eleanor Health, an innovative company built on equity and justice that develops mental health medical homes for individuals affected by the opioid and other substance use disorders. She's an expert on the medical aspects of addiction and other psychiatric disorders. As co-founder and vice chair of the Board of Physicians for Criminal Justice Reform, she leads advocacy at the intersection of health and criminal justice. I came across Dr. Harrison several years ago while listening to her speak so well on the subject of substance use disorder on a Lemonada Media podcast called Last Day. Now she has her own podcast called In Recovery, where she engages a large audience on topics related to addiction. Dr. Harrison, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So I would love it if you could start by talking about the connection that you've seen in your work between early childhood stress, trauma, and addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not even strong enough to call it a connection. They are inextricably woven. And so there's this concept of the ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, which is a big study done by Kaiser a couple of decades ago that predicts if you have these experiences in childhood that are traumatic, your risk for developing all chronic medical conditions, substance use disorder, depression, anxiety, diabetes, obesity, smoking, heart attack, premature labor, is predicted by what happened to you in childhood, really, regardless of what happened in the middle. And so that's like abuse, neglect, parents who were divorced or separated, losing a family member to incarceration. There are 10 different adverse childhood experiences. And those are not even necessarily, I mean, abuse and neglect, people would probably think of as traumatic, but we have this such narrow concept of what trauma is that people look at their life experiences and say, I don't have the right to say I've been traumatized.
Right. Exactly.
Even though those experiences are continuing to predict your life experience today and your health today, depression, anxiety, substance use disorders, those others that I mentioned. And so it is super well characterized in the health literature, the impact that those traumatic life experiences, especially in childhood, have on us every day as adults.
And, you know, I want to talk about Eleanor Health for sure and why you opened Eleanor Health. But when you're seeing people and you're treating people for substance use disorders or psychiatric problems, I have found that sometimes you're having to educate them about their trauma experiences, right? They haven't acknowledged the role that their trauma had in their substance use problems.
Yeah, for sure. And sometimes it hasn't acknowledged, like, I know that I had these trauma and I haven't acknowledged that this is contributing to my risky alcohol and other drug use. Sometimes it is, I didn't even realize that was a trauma. Like that was the experience of, you know, where I grew up and how people grew up. And so I just thought that's just how it is. And I didn't realize that that set me up to be dealing with what I'm dealing with today. Right. And then other times it's like, I knew I was traumatized. And I know I have trouble with alcohol and drugs today, but I didn't know there's a connection. Or I know I have trouble with depression and anxiety, but I didn't know there's a connection. And so we do all three of those levels of education and support for people. And it's remarkable because it can be scary, right? Like as humans, I think in general, if I can make a big broad statement, definitely as Americans, you're taught like, you have ultimate choice over your behaviors and what you do with your life. And that comes with a big burden of responsibility and judgment, especially when it's just not true, right?
Right.
It's just not true. We are the product of all of this that's going on externally and then physiologically, all of this that's going on internally. And so sometimes when you just give people the compassion and understanding that like this that you experienced, even though you were 5 years old, yes, is having a huge impact on you today at 32 years old, because the message they've been getting since then is like, you're an adult now, just get it together.
Right.
It makes a huge difference for people.
And I'm assuming that at Eleanor Health, and please tell me about it, what was the inspiration behind starting Eleanor Health?
Yeah, so I'm co-founder and chief medical officer of Eleanor Health. This is definitely like the most exciting, one of the most important things I've done professionally in my life. The most important things I've done in my life are those kids, 14 and 16 years old, who are amazing. My husband as well, I guess marrying him led to the kids.
But I'm glad to know that counts.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yes, babe, you are also amazing. Thank you. Eleanor Health, we actually started because, as everyone knows, addiction treatment in this country is broken. And it's broken for a few reasons. One, lack of understanding that addiction and substance use disorder specifically are chronic medical illnesses. So you can't cure it with a 3-day detox. You can't cure it with a 30-day residential rehab stay. It's like if you had diabetes and you went in the hospital for a 5-day stay, and then they sent you out with no insulin, no diet education, no nutrition support, no primary care doctor, dropped you off in front of a donut shop and said, good luck living, right? Like, it would never happen. And this is pretty much what's happening in addiction treatment. And so there's a lot of evidence base for how we can treat these illnesses that the medical community and general community at large is not being held to. And on the other side, the way we pay for healthcare in this country is like, you see a doctor, you get a bill, you pay it, incentivizes quantity of care, but it doesn't matter whether people are getting better. Like, where's the accountability to quality of care? And so we founded Eleanor Health, one, to practice whole person care of people with addictions, which means you have to have psychiatry, you have to have therapy, you have to have support for social drivers of health, housing, life meaning, purpose, stress, financial stability, dream casting, right? Like, you have to support all of that if you're going to get any chronic medical illness in order, addiction especially. But you also have to be accountable to outcomes. And so we founded Eleanor Health to say, like, let's do a different payment. Let's negotiate a different payment structure. Let's provide a compassionate, whole person, longitudinal experience that's actually caring about people. And let's see if we can make a difference. And we are. It's remarkable. It's remarkable.
That's amazing. And you mentioned a little bit earlier about kind of the normalization of especially like ACEs. Mm-hmm. And it occurs to me that, you know, whether it was the family system that you grew up in or your neighborhood or your state or your country, that there's all of these familial and societal and cultural factors that play into someone's risk for childhood adversity and also for trauma.
Yeah.
So I would love if you could talk about like what you've seen through your lens about kind of unpacking all of that and all of those aspects as you're educating people in at Eleanor Health or that you see in other capacities around substance use disorder.
Yeah. And so it's so funny. We take this very narrow view of healthcare, like it's just what happens in the hospital or it's just what happens in the doctor's office. And I have this good friend, David, who's a healthcare economist. He's been on the show in recovery. And he said, we have to stop thinking about healthcare services and we have to start thinking about health. Because if you think about health, all of your health happens outside of that doctor's visit, happens outside of that hospital. And what we know is when you grow up in a war-torn town, when you grow up in poverty, when you grow up with adults who generationally have been traumatized, when you grow up marginalized, when you grow up with racism as part of your everyday experience, when you grow up with identity threats because you're LGBTQ and people telling you that who you are is wrong, all of this physiologically is setting us up for the stress axis abnormalities, the development of the brain, the development of coping systems, coping skills, the ability to weather the adversity of just like that normal life brings us a pandemic, right. COVID, right? Like, don't let me drop that into normal by any means.
Right.
But like when you've been raised by generationally traumatized adults who can't help you with that, and the environment is continuing to beat you down rather than nourish you, then you have to be able to wrap your arms around all of that and help people wrap their arms around all of that in a way that empowers them to say, because one, so much stigma, you can't even say, I feel traumatized.
Right.
You can't even say, I think I'm depressed. You can't even say, I think I might be drinking too much. Right. You can say, I think I want to stop smoking. It took us 2 decades to even,
give
people permission to want to stop smoking cigarettes. Right. And so in this environment that we have, and it's so interesting because the studies are showing us that like there are positive childhood experiences,
right,
that can mitigate adverse childhood experiences. We're like not even talking about the power we have to practice prevention. So you can't help if you were born into poverty, but even in neighborhoods that are impoverished, a sense of community undermines the effect of that poverty on the individuals in it. And so it's like, when you live in a neighborhood that's impoverished, but 1 mile up the street is an affluent neighborhood, that's where the poverty has the most impact on the people in that neighborhood, right? It's disparity. It's lack of connection, which is biological. We're pack animals. It's lack of future vision, meaning, and purpose. And so if we could be, one, trying to reduce those things that drive trauma, obviously, but that takes a long time. And I like to approach that very systematically. So my people come in, we do an ACEs score. I told you there are 10 items. If you score 4 or more, like high risk, right? Like if you score 4 or more, that definitely has something to do with what we're talking about today.
Right.
And so, no, you can't go back and change that, but we can address your score. And also, if you have kids, if you're part of other people's lives, we can start working on trying to minimize what their score is individually. Systemically, we should be trying to figure out how do we minimize the scores of the next generation of kids. And then Absolutely. You do that, you connect people, you lead with compassion, like all of these physiologically change us to help us get healthier.
You said so many things that I want to follow up
on. I know,
on.
I'm sorry. I'm like,
no, it's not that you...
My media coach is like, shorten your answers. I'm like, sorry, can't.
No, you're doing fantastic. That's not it. I was just like, oh, I want to talk more about that. And I want to talk more about that. No, you're doing fantastic. First, you hit upon the reason that trauma work is so important to me, which is breaking those intergenerational cycles, right? You can't fix what you're not aware of. You can't change right. A behavior or a pattern yeah. or a coping mechanism that you know does not serve your children mm-hmm. or the next generation. And also in that systemic way, in the neighborhood way, the importance of post-traumatic growth and why I want this work to come out in the world and for people to understand more is because the science is saying that if you have one secure attached adult, right? Just one, your entire, and it doesn't matter who it is. It could be a teacher. It could be a shop owner. It could be a librarian. It could be a close family friend or somebody in the neighborhood. It could be anyone that has this kind of capacity to hold and break that cycle. Then those ACEs have much less impact on right. that person, right?
Yeah, you can change the trajectory. And I mentioned my kids are 14 and 16. And I told them they like get health data every day of their lives. They're like, okay. And I'm like, you know, for adolescents who are members of LGBTQ community, one supportive adult reduces their risk of suicide attempt by 44%. I said, you and all of your friends, you let them know if they don't have that adult, I will be that adult for them. Right? Like it's a small thing with massive, massive positive impact.
Absolutely. You said something earlier that I actually, a term I hadn't heard before, so I would love it if you could explain for me, but the stress axis abnormalities?
Oh, yeah. I'm talking, so our stress axis, you have your, oh, now you're going to turn me into a nerd. So you have your hypothalamus, your pituitary gland, and then that goes to your adrenal glands, your HPA axis. We call that your stress axis. Probably the main hormone that people have heard of is cortisol. And so what we know is that under periods of stress, our bodies respond with cortisol to prepare us physiologically for survival. Like, and so that survival is dump glucose into your bloodstream. So when you have a constantly elevated stress axis, you can draw the direct line to diabetes. That is, that stress axis is narrow your blood vessels so you can get your blood pressure up so that you can be on, you know, aware, your fight or flight with norepinephrine and adrenaline mixed in there. You can draw a direct line to heart attacks, high blood pressure. When we look at that cortisol axis, we can draw a direct line to the brain, to your amygdala, which is anxiety and depression and your limbic system. And so we know is when we have people, like when people say nature or nurture, I'm like, yes. And then I always threaten to fight people that don't believe me. I'm like, if you want to take it in the street and fight, we can fight, right? Because it's like our bodies physiologically are constantly every nanosecond adapting to this environment. And when there's constant stress, that stress axis, that HPA axis, that cortisol is constantly elevated. And that's actually changing us physiologically in ways that we pass on to the next generation. Physiologically, it's changing us in ways psychologically that make us less resilient. And so we tend to prepare people in recovery and substance use disorder treatment for the big events. Like if somebody dies, how are you going to keep yourself safe? If the pandemic comes, how are you going to prevent a relapse? If you get fired from your job, how are you going to not fall prey to the cravings that will come? But the literature shows us that it's the cumulative everyday stressors, not having enough time, not feeling good enough, not quite knowing where the next, you know, like how the kids are going to get to school. Like those chronic cumulative stressors are actually what chip away at our health even more than the big events.
And you mentioned, you know, marginalized communities earlier. And if you have multiples of that Venn diagram overlapping, right, you're a person of color and you're LGBTQ and, you know, maybe you don't speak English as a first language. Like there's so many, you're also in an impoverished neighborhood. Like all of those factors, just getting to the bus stop and getting to work, figuring out where you're going to eat next, what's safe, who's safe, where am I going to encounter microaggressions or major aggressions,
right?
That just constant hum of anticipatory stress leads to trauma, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. And you're describing this concept of cumulative burden. And it's a cumulative psychological burden. It's a cumulative physiological burden. Like our health disparities show us that, like the more number of, and I don't use the word minority. I stopped using the word minority in medical school because language is extremely important. And our concept of the minority in this country is that your voice doesn't matter, right? The majority wins. And so I do not use the word minority, but this concept was originally developed as cumulative minority burden. Woman, person of color, English is not your first language, living in a poor neighborhood, LGBTQ, like all of the ways that we marginalize people in this country. The more of those you layer on, the shorter your lifespan is, the more likely you are to have a chronic medical condition, the more likely you are to have a high ACEs score, the more likely you are to have a low PCEs score, even though there's not a PCEs score, I made that up, positive childhood experiences, right? You're less likely to have those and more likely to have the adverse ones. And so to what you were saying earlier, it's like, if we can just empower ourselves with this information, we actually have the ability to change the trajectory, but it starts with connection. First and foremost, we are pack animals, and all of that marginalization are ways that we're kicking people out of the pack. And when an animal gets kicked out of a pack, what does it do? It slinks away and it dies. And that's what we see happening. That's what trauma is. And it slinks away and it dies, and nobody remembers that that animal was even ever part of the pack, right? And so that's what we're doing, is kicking people out of the pack, traumatizing them along the way, pushing them to a slow death, whether that's death while you're alive or whether that's death.
I'm so glad that you spoke to that, the cumulative physiological stress that is incorporated into all of this, because I feel like so many people see traumatic experiences as something that you can cognitively like decide through positive thinking to not burden yourself with, or to move beyond, or to, you know, if it's a judgment of like, if I were strong enough, or if you were strong enough, it's normally, if you were strong enough, this would not as deeply affect you. And I can tell you that I can't like positive think my way into my amygdala and my hypothalamus, like adrenal glands function. Like that's not how it works. I can't just like positively think my way. It might contribute beneficially to my system, but that's out of my control.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Like, and I always drop it into physical health conditions because it's easier for people to draw that line. Can you positively think yourself into a cancer remission? It absolutely contributes. But is the expectation that you just positively think yourself into your breast cancer going into remission? That would be an unfair expectation. Can you just positively think yourself into controlled blood sugar for diabetes? It contributes. Like, let's not undermine the contribution for sure. But that would be an unfair expectation. The same is true here. We are physiological animals. And our thoughts, our emotions, our behaviors start as physiology and experience, just like cancer and diabetes start as physiology and experience. And so let's apply the same level of accountability and compassion and expectation. Like, let's be fair about it. Let's give ourselves a chance.
Absolutely. And, you know, you were talking about kind of the stigma and the shame earlier. And I think that so much of that comes from this othering that we do, that it's like when people get divorced, the first question that most people ask is like, what happened, right? Because they want to like somehow learn some knowledge that will prevent that from happening to them. And when with mental health disorders, with substance use disorders, it feels like once someone knows that that's happening in your family or in your immediate circle, it's like it's catching, right? And they don't want to hear anything about it. But now we've had this shared traumatic experience with COVID. And even though all of our experiences have been different, we've all been impacted. And so things like, you know, drinking or using prescription drugs to cope with stress, or using our phones or devices as distractions, all fine in moderate use, but can progressively grow. Like, somebody doesn't wake up one day and all of a sudden they're dealing with a substance use addiction, right? These are progressive diseases. And so for people who at home are unfamiliar with substance use disorders, addiction, psychiatric disorders, and aren't, they haven't been touched by that yet in their family systems or in their social circles, what would you tell them now about this shared trauma experience that we've all had, and paying attention to kind of the way that you're using substances or using avoidance tactics in your life now to cope with that stress?
Mm-hmm. I would say, number one, find me the person that hasn't been touched. So my number one message is that you have been touched. Somebody in your life is dealing with depression, anxiety, risky substance use disorder, addiction to technology, sex, porn, gambling. Somebody in your life, possibly you, is dealing with it. And so, like, that's the first thing to recognize, is that these experiences are universal. To your comment about othering, there's no other. It is us. All of us are in this stew. So if we can just start there, that's my number one stigma busting strategy. It's like, it is all of us. And so if we take it out of, I'm going to answer your question, I promise. We take it out.
I know you will. I have confidence.
Out of addiction for just a second. When you think about addiction, the broad definition that we use on the podcast in recovering is something you keep doing despite negative consequences. Mm-hmm. Something you want to change that has been difficult for you to change, even though you've tried. And so when you drop it into that framework, everybody can say like, oh man, yeah, I wanted to work less. I've tried really hard to work less. I go through periods where I'm working less, and then I relapse to periods where my working is out of control. And we don't judge that the same way we drug to alcohol or cocaine or heroin, but it's the exact same neurobiological pathway in your brain.
So because it's something like working too much has positive external consequences, right? So it's less stigmatized, but internally has the same kind of toxic consequences, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so I think the first step is recognizing that it's all of us. What this pandemic has done for us from a mental health perspective is made it okay to say, I'm not okay. And I think that's the second thing for people who are starting to see in themselves, I feel like I'm not okay. I feel like I'm languishing. I feel like I'm depressed. I feel like I'm anxious. I'm definitely drinking more. I had stopped smoking cigarettes. I'm smoking again. Marijuana just became legal. I didn't think I'd be eating edibles every day, but I am, right? I'm concerned about this person in my life. I don't know how to bring it up. Like, the pandemic has made it okay, one, to say I'm not okay. I think the next step we have to take is being able to make it okay to say to somebody we're concerned about, are you okay? Because I think I see you not being okay. And so just to give some very concrete how people can possibly know if you're not okay, it is thoughts, it's emotions, it's behaviors. And it's really noticing a difference in yourself and your ability to function without this sense of struggle. So you may still be functioning at an acceptable level, but if you're struggling, like you feel a struggle to function there, whether that's spending time with your family, getting your work done, being able to find things that bring you joy, not biting people's heads off, being able to sleep at night, having body aches and headaches, feeling anxious, right? Like, you see how I mixed in thoughts, feelings, behaviors. That's where you're going to see it. Other people are going to see you struggling before you see you struggling. Mm. Because this is coming from the brain, and we use our brains to know when we're struggling, right? So it's like asking the brain to know that it's struggling. Other people will see that for you first. And so make sure you have a trusted set of people that you've said to, if you see me struggling, please ask me if I'm okay. And if I'm struggling, can I please say to you, I'm not okay, right? Like, back to that conversation we were having before, one trusted person.
Yeah.
Just one trusted person that you can say to, I'm not okay. This is what I'm seeing in myself. So if you used to drink a couple of times a week out with your friends, and now you're drinking a glass every night, you're like, one glass every night's not a big deal. That's a big increase. You don't want to wait for it to be a big deal. If you used to, you know, smoke weed when you went to Vegas with your friends, and now you find somebody to bring you weed and you're smoking a couple times a week, no. In the big scheme of things, weed a couple times a week is not a big deal. That's a big increase for you. Like, that's your brain giving you a warning symptom. We're struggling. We need to intervene now. And so where we mess up in healthcare, physical healthcare and mental healthcare in this country, is that we wait until it's a real problem. And then it's hard to intervene. And that's because it's not okay to say, I think I might not be okay.
Absolutely. And I'm imagining several scenarios. First, I want to speak to the person who is having trouble with accessibility, whether it be affordability, whether it be a geographical problem, right? There's many, many areas in this country where access to the kind of healthcare that you're talking about is inaccessible, whether it's an ability problem, right? So let's say we recognize that we've got an issue and we don't have that person in our lives that we can ask for support. What would you say to that person?
The internet has connected us in beautiful ways, and COVID has forced us to use the internet in ways that we have not used it before. And so there are so many communities where people just do not have access to a trusted person to support. There's an app for that. But then that used to be a phrase. There's an app for that. There's an app for that. If you Google, there is an online support system. And I know it is not the same as like being in the same space and putting your arms around someone. But this concept of harm reduction is like, take what you can get. A little bit is better than nothing. So even, I mean, at Eleanor Health, we have free, and we did this during the pandemic, free online support groups that you can come to for people who think, I don't know, I might be struggling, I'm not sure. For people who know for sure I'm struggling with substances, I want some support. For people who have a family member or loved one that they're concerned about, we have specific groups for LGBTQ plus community members. We have specific groups for Black community members to create spaces of safety. Free, no obligation, just come. And people from all around the world are connecting in those virtual settings just to have a safe space to come and say, I think I might not be okay. And to get support around that. And so like, use the internet, find an app. I have this app that I love. They should pay me for this endorsement. They don't even know that I exist. They don't even know that I am one of their users. Called Wobot, W-O-E-B-O-T. It's so cute. And it's literally just like out of the blue, Wobot will be like, hey, Nzinga, how are you feeling today? And then and it just gives you like three choices, like a smiley face, a straight face, or a sad face. And if I put a straight face, it's like, well, let's talk about one thing you can do to turn that straight face into a smile face. It is a bot. I know good and well that is not a person. But it makes me smile a little bit because it's a cute little bot and it made me take stock of myself. I didn't even realize I was straight faced today. Mm. So now let me go find somebody in my life or some activity in my life that can, you know, help my straight face. So just like use everything at your disposal. Use everything. Yeah. Just go outside, get sunshine. You know, find one thing that you do that reliably makes you sigh a little sigh of relief. Do that at least 3 to 4 times a week. Like we have to be so creative right now. And people that don't have good access, unfortunately, have the burden of being even more creative. But it starts with just being able to say, I think I need something more or different. I feel myself struggling.
And I'm so glad that you named just kind of the normalization of all of this online abundance of accessibility now, because it is all over the place. And I know I have people that I've supported through substance use disorders, and many of them were in multiple marginalized communities. And a lot of, you know, just to be frank about it, church basements just didn't feel safe for them.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they weren't safe, but they didn't feel safe. And that the anticipatory stress was contributing to their inability to commit to being in recovery, right? So this accessibility, these online groups where you know that you're going to have at least not necessarily guaranteed safety, but at least knock off some of the risk factors,
That's right.
Of safety. And when you named Wobot, what occurred to me is just like, we are so sometimes detached from how we feel in our bodies, and having even an AI that provides us with the script to touch in with ourselves.
That's right.
It's like, once you get into the practice of that, then your brain starts to like internalize, like, oh, I know what this script is. Like, maybe I can do this myself. I've become a person that just in the last couple of months, because of how enthusiastic I am about my work, is forgetting to eat lunch. And if you ever knew me throughout my life, I don't forget to eat. Like, that's, there are people for whom that's like,
that
normal.
Is not what I do.
Not me. That is not who I am. Food is my ministry. Food is fuel. And so just like touching in with myself regularly these last couple of weeks and just being like, okay, how have you nourished yourself today? How have, you know, how does your body feel? What does it need? What would bring in energy and focus and all of the things that you need to do your job for the wonderful people at home?
Yes.
So I'm going to check out
Lightweight. Yeah, totally. Check out Wobot. I love it. I'm going to tell them, give me an endorsement. But I actually love it. It's funny, if you listen to the podcast this last season, if you listen to the podcast the first season, you never heard me mention macaroni and cheese. If you listen to the podcast this season, I feel like almost every episode I've talked about macaroni and cheese. And
it's like the Easter egg of every episode.
Yeah, it's like the Easter egg. And it seems lightweight, but what I recognized, and this, I mean, like, as a physician, psychiatrist, addiction expert, like I know this, carbs actually physiologically make emotional pain feel better, like physiologically throughout the brain and the body, they do. And so I got a little obsessed with macaroni and cheese to the point that I'm like literally searching the Uber Eats app, not by restaurant name or geography or location, by the words
macaroni
and cheese. And like looking at the pictures to make sure that a good batch of mac and cheese comes. And I noticed that like, oh, when I start obsessing about mac and cheese, it's because I'm struggling. It has probably been true my whole life because I used to have nicknames associated with macaroni and cheese because people know that I love cheese, right? But like it took this last year of really being stretched to the edge and then Facebook friends making jokes like, oh my God, all you talk about is macaroni and cheese. And I'm like, this does seem excessive. And my kids saying, Mom, we had mac and cheese 3 days this week for dinner. It's like, something's going on here. And so now I'm in front of that. When I start thinking about mac and cheese, then I take stock of myself. And so if Wobot, people in your life, self-help books, television shows, websites can help you learn how to take stock of yourself. That's how we grab the power. What is this? Where is it coming from? Then you get to, what can I start to do about it?
And I love that you used yourself as an example because we're all subject to this. All of us do it. It's incredibly normal. It's part of the human experience, right?
Yeah.
And it was also, you reflected that it was some the other people in your life pointing it out that you were not even conscious like, of dude. It, right?
Yeah, they're like, dude, you're the amount of cognitive space that mac and cheese takes up for you is just not normal. And I was like, correct. But it's mac and cheese. Nobody's going to judge me for that. What if it was cocaine?
Exactly, right?
What if it was alcohol?
Mac and cheese is an acceptable coping mechanism to externally to other people. It's not judged. And carbs are our friends. I'm not going to demon. You're not finding a friend in me.
Well, but only because we're not obese. Like only because I'm thin. If I had been struggling with morbid obesity, posted about mac and cheese all the time, trust me, the comments would not have been compassionate.
It's absolutely true. Absolutely true. So I want to talk through if you're a trusted person in somebody's life and they come to you and they say, you know, I think I'm struggling. I have a problem. But even though you're a trusted person, you don't know what to say in that moment and you don't know what to do, right? Because you can be an incredibly safe and trustable person, but still not have the response ready for that situation. So what is the advice that you would give that person?
First is that it's perfectly fine to say, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. So think of it exactly like if a person calls you and says, today I got diagnosed with breast cancer. You don't know how to fix it. You don't know what to tell them where to go. You don't know what to say. What you know that they need is compassion and warm arms. And a person that says, I have no idea what to do in this situation, but I will be here with you and we will figure it out. And I'm going to be here with you. And so that's what the quote right response is. You don't have to have the answers. You don't have to know where the resources are. If you can respond with the same level of empathy and compassion that you would if that person said, I just found out I'll have cancer, you would say, whatever it is. First, you would just hug them and say, I'm so glad you knew you could tell me. And then you would say, tell me what you need. Whatever it is, we're going to figure it out. Whether you go in remission, whether your disease stays active, whether you have periods of relapse, I'm going to be here with this compassion and this motivation to help you figure it out. That's the first thing to say. And then from there, you go about trying to figure it out. And that is unfortunately quite difficult in this web system of a mess that we have. But it's just, I will continue to be that person for you. Like, you are not on this road trip alone. That is all you have to be prepared to say.
I love that you said that. I had someone close to me that went through recovery and was in a rehab center, and this person called, and what struck me was that they said, you know, a lot of the people that have come in at the same time that I have don't have anyone to call. Mm-hmm. They don't know where they're going to go when they leave, mm-hmm. when they, you know, their insurance runs out, or they're not allowed to stay here anymore, or when the programs run its course, they don't have anywhere to go. They don't know all of the, you know, they don't have anywhere to go. And on the one hand, like, I have a lot of compassion for people who have been put in that position of creating healthy boundaries around how they're going to have somebody with substance abuse disorder in their lives. And on the other hand, if we created that compassion at the first stage, and some of these people that he was speaking about had been in rehab multiple times, there were multiple, they needed multiple steps of help, which is how recovery, we were talking before we started recording about how recovery is not a straight linear process, right? So actually, maybe we should just speak for just a minute about what recovery looks like, right? And what our expectations might be for recovery and then what it actually is.
Yeah, so I'll get to recovery, which is a bigger concept. I'll start with a narrower medical concept, which is remission. So when we talk about a chronic relapsing remitting condition in medicine, a relapse is when your symptoms are active. Remission is when your symptoms are not active. Relapse is when your symptoms come back. And so when we think about that for substance use disorder, the symptoms are not just using the drug. Addiction to sex, porn, gambling, technology, work, the food, the symptom is not just eating. The symptom is not just working. The symptom is not just gambling. There's a lot that wraps around that. There's using, there's failing to fulfill major role obligations, there's psychological consequences, physical consequences, social consequences. And so when we say a person has relapsed for addiction or substance use disorder, it's some collection of all of that. When we get to this concept of recovery, the reason I start there is because the concept of recovery cannot be so narrow that it is just not using or not doing whatever that thing is. The concept of recovery has to be biological, physiological recovery, has to be psychological. So we have to address those childhood experiences, those adolescent experiences, those ongoing adult experiences. It has to be social. We have to address those cumulative everyday stressors that are chipping away at your resilience. It has to be cultural. We have to be feeding and nourishing a healthy recovery-based identity for you that feeds meaning and life purpose and future trajectory. And so recovery is constantly being threatened by everyday factors, right? Mm. And I think where we mess up is that we have this very narrow concept that, like, recovery is a straight line of just not using, when in actuality, it's an infinite number of pathways, because today I might be physiologically ill, I might have COVID. And yes, the psychological stress of COVID puts me at risk for a reemergence of my addiction symptoms, but also the physiological burden is literally changing my brain's ability to make a different decision when a craving comes. That's physiologically putting me at risk, right? Like, psychologically, I've dealt with my adverse childhood experiences. And I don't think you can ever put that in past tense. So like, I'm dealing with them. I have, you know, empowered myself to recognize those strategies that work. But then I'm walking down the street and I see something that triggers me. That has to be part of the recovery. That's like one of the infinite paths, right? I go in the store and I go in the nail shop. I'm a man to get my nails painted red. And they turn their nose up at me and refuse to serve me. That cultural identity infraction has to be part of recovery. And so when we expect people to just be able to say, I stopped using and 10 years ago and I've been in recovery for 10 years. No, you have to take that broader view, and all of us play a role in that: compassion, connection. And just because the symptoms of the illness reemerge, there's a relapse, doesn't mean that person didn't want to be in recovery, doesn't mean they didn't do something right, doesn't mean their choices are bad and they're not strong enough. Back to cancer. When a woman has a relapse, or a man, of their breast cancer, we don't say, what did you do to cause this? We say like, all right, let's look back and see all the things that contributed and try to not do those, you know, try to change whatever that is. But it's not, what did you do to cause this? And so the same is true for recovery. There are an infinite number of pathways in. There are an infinite number of forces constantly pushing on it. And so if a relapse comes, I also don't like when people say relapse is part of the disease. It's true. Relapse is also part of the disease of cancer. And you don't tell people with cancer it's inevitable that you're going to relapse, because that's stealing people's hopes. Like, that's mean. So let's not do that to people with addiction and substance use disorders either, right? Like, that's mean. So like, we're going to do everything we can to prevent a relapse. But if it comes, we're not going to say, what did you do wrong? And it's your fault. We're going to look at all of the factors. And we're going to look at what we can do differently, but it's a windy path, and it's always going to be a windy path, because life is a windy path and humans are windy.
And I know for me personally speaking, as the support person of people in recovery, my triggers and my expectations have been a really interesting invitation for me to get curious about my own trauma related to their substance abuse or use. Right. So that's something that I've had to get curious about over the last few years. Like, is this behavior a signal of use, or is this behavior my trauma showing that I need to investigate? Is this story I'm making up about this person's behavior or actions or words a harbinger of doom, or is this my trauma? Right. And so there's trauma on both sides of that experience. And I just kind of need to acknowledge that.
100%. I'm so glad that you brought that out, because if you're the support person for anyone with any chronic progressive illness, substance use disorders included, you need support for yourself. So I would say this to a person who's the support person for someone with Alzheimer's disease, for someone who had a stroke, for someone with cancer, for someone with really malignant diabetes. That takes an emotional, psychological, cognitive relationship toll on you. And so, of course, when we get pushed as support people to the ends of our coping, our compassion starts to degrade, because you have to protect yourself. That's normal. And so what you need is support for yourself, so that protecting yourself doesn't have to turn into harming the other person. You can draw healthy boundaries and protect yourself and still be compassionate to that other person at the same time. It's possible to set compassionate and not punitive boundaries. And so I use the example, like, we have lots of substance use disorder in my family on both sides. On my mom's side, aunts and uncles with severe cocaine, alcohol use disorders. And this particular uncle who, no shade to the rest of my uncles, is my favorite uncle. growing up had really severe cocaine addiction, still struggles, periods of relapse and remission. My grandmother was the boundary. You can't live here because it's not safe for us, for you to live here, but you can always come home. You can always call. You can always come visit. And we had a lot of safety, you know, mechanisms that we had to enact when he came to visit because his illness was super severe. But it was like, you can always call me. You can always come to visit. You can always come to Christmas. You can always come to Thanksgiving. We want you to. But that healthy boundary was for emotional and physical safety, you cannot live here.
Right.
That's a hard boundary to set on your child.
It is.
But she had to do that to protect herself. And she did that in a way that was compassionate, not punitive. It is easier to do that when you have someone supporting you as the support person to the person with the illness.
Absolutely. This has been fantastic. I think that's a great place for us to finish up. Dr. Nzinga Harrison, where can people find out more about you and Eleanor Health?
Okay, eleanorhealth.com. Please join us. We've put a lot of intention into our website to hopefully make it feel like a warm, compassionate place where you see yourself. Definitely check out the free support groups at Eleanor Health. If I can plug also the podcast In Recovery, we try to lead with compassion as well as practical advice. So definitely reach out there. And you can find me on Twitter at N.A. Harrison, M.D., if you're a tweeting type of person.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This was great. Thank you so much for leading this conversation.